Good to be back.
And last week, and I've been thinking about this all week, we were talking about the relevance of Finnegan's Wake to rock criticism. And it's a topic I really want to have another go at because it flies in the face of so much boring common sense. Because what could a highly avant-garde book written in Paris, developed with a circle of secret cult followers, have to do with a widespread pop phenomenon done by people who've never heard of Finnegan's Wake? You know, how can you connect these two things? And I'm absolutely convinced you're right, and that I realise that I come from the same place, and I haven't quite articulated it like that. I don't know quite why I haven't. But that the separation between those two, between rock and Finnegan's Wake, is, you're making me feel it's more crucial. I think I've always behaved from the basis that those two things are crucial to bring together, but I'm not sure I've really acted on it yet. So I'm interested in what you thought over the week after our discussion last week.
Well, I reviewed the last bit of last week's show just to see what I knew we didn't complete something. And I heard you respond to my idea in the last part of show number 27, where I was saying Finnegan's Wake is rock and roll in print. And you quibble with that, and then you made it your understanding, and it was exactly right. You said, I can understand your statement, Bob, if I see that the inflections of language in Finnegan's Wake anticipated the inflections that happen in rock and blues and electrified music. That's exactly the point.
And this is bringing in mechanical recording as a revolution in aesthetics. And I think here Walter Benjamin's famous artwork essay is very helpful, because he's dealing with the same thing, which is once you have mechanical recording, and mechanical has a slightly bad ring to it in current discourse. If you say something's mechanical, it's like it's not really thought through, or it's not spontaneous, or something kind of boring about it. And that's not what Walter Benjamin means. What he means is, instead of going by the hand and the eye, a direct imprint like a photograph or like recording onto tape or onto vinyl or what have you, that imprint, you're taking something from reality which is not going via your conscious control. You can take photographs and then look at them afterwards and unpack them, which is what the writer Ian Sinclair does. That's how he writes. And this new technologies of recording actually form the basis of a possible revolution in aesthetics, which hasn't happened. I mean, we had modernism in the 20th century, we had Finnegan's Wake, but it was sidelined, and so many people are not in touch with it, even though they desperately need it. And I think that's how I feel about the counterculture in the 60s, that it threw up amazing, fantastic music, and there were fantastic people, and it was a fantastic movement. But it lacked connection with the revolution that had happened in the 1920s and 30s. And that lack of connection actually ruined it.
And that is where we agree and disagree about the reasons about that disconnection, about the consequences. Finnegan's Wake, okay, so the Finnegan's, the rhythms of life that rock and roll and hip-hop addressed in the second half of the 20th century, the changes in sensibility, not aesthetics as conceptual definition, but changes in sensibility, rock met that. People lived more hyper lives, and more complex lives, and more experience. And, you know, jet planes come in by 1916. People are traveling all over the world. That was not possible before. So the change in sensibility creates different rhythms, and I think that's like T.S. Eliot says, the automobile changed the rhythms, and poetry must reflect that or adapt to the rhythms of the people who use the automobiles. That he said that back in the 20s. So I find that the rhythms of life that rock and electrified reality created are mapped out in Finnegan's Wake. I can say Finnegan's Wake is not only rock and roll in print, it's rock in print, it's TV in print, it's digital life in print. That's the amazing achievement, that it bypassed the Gutenberg galaxy, the book world, and dealt with the new rhythms. So when you say that the inflections that tape recording brought in are anticipated by Finnegan's Wake, or at least he's addressing it as if the book was a tape recording, that's an important achievement. And so then you talk about the way it was in the 60s, and it misses the aesthetics or the revolutionary concepts from the 30s. We have to take Finnegan's Wake's warning, and this is what McClellan emphasized, that new electrified environments change people's sensibilities, so they can't hear or see or remember the concepts from the 30s. That's the issue here.
I've spent, you know, ever since I discovered Finnegan's Wake at the age of 15 in the school library, I've been pulling it off the shelf and showing it to people, expecting them to respond to it as immediately as I did. Because when I first saw it, I'd never read anything by James Joyce. I think my brother had said that he was a difficult writer, and he was joking that I was so precocious I'd already read James Joyce. I asked my mother, what's James Joyce? I think I've mentioned this before. But I liked it as soon as I saw it, and I always expect people to have that response, and so often they don't do that. What they say is, oh well, I'm not really ready to read something like that, I haven't read other works by Joyce, I don't know anything about modern literature. And I'm saying, no, this book is against all those thoughts. This book is in defiance of the idea that you need a special training to approach a book. Have a look at it, you know, enjoy it, look into it. And the more educated people are, the less likely they are to look into the book. It's
because they think it's a book.
Yeah, and that's what I think I found very stimulating about Frank Zappa's attitude towards higher education, is that has a continual criticism of higher education as actually de-educating people. And he's saying that he found in his uneducated R&B musicians people with a greater sense of reality than in higher education, that attitude and that is real knowledge that he's passing through or getting in touch with and become a channel for to new listeners.
And he was responding to the new technologies because it was part of his career. It's like businessmen don't like academics. Academics are book people. They don't deal with the problems of using Microsoft technology in your business. So the business has to deal with practical situations. Frank was, quote, a businessman. He is a young kid, got into a recording studio, and he had to be up on the latest technology to enhance his vision.
But he's not a businessman from
the obsolescence of the book world.
Yeah, but he's not a businessman from the point of view of his intent. He complained bitterly about who are these people who sell music like it's shoes, you know, marketing consultants.
I'm talking about the businessman and Zappa. When you're making stuff, you have to deal with the latest technology, and you're not interested in some ideas from a book. Book people are in academia. It changed over the last 30 years, but back then, the 50s, 60s, academia was back and the book was the god and all that, and they were totally out of it and didn't have a clue what was going on. And that's part of the reason why McLuhan became famous, is that the academic says, well, here's someone among our university world who can at least talk about this world I don't know anything about. And that's why he became famous at the beginning. He was like an apologist for the university life, or at least the university people say, well, at least here we got one guy here who knows about the Beatles and what's going on, you know? But McLuhan was more than that. But he took advantage of that felt need in academia. So you have this book mentality. They look at Finnegan's Wake and they don't realize it's about a whole world that's happened since the book, and Joyce is addressing it. Look at Ulysses and look at two pages. Well, this guy's in tune, he's on the right track, he didn't have to study it, he just knew this guy was dealing with the present, his present.
And this is where I'd like, suddenly I feel that we could generate the script for a really fantastic screwball comedy, and you would be the guy who's convinced that Finnegan's Wake is actually the new business manual, and you go and you have an office somewhere on where would be appropriate, sort of off Wall Street, the business section of New York. I don't know New York well enough to think of the place, but you'd have this little office and you'd be bringing in people with for seminars, and you'd have a flip chart and you'd wear a suit and you'd walk up and down sweating slightly as you expound Finnegan's Wake, and you have the responses on everybody's faces.
I have done that. And I learned a lot about it from McLuhan. But McLuhan did a whole book for businessmen called Take Today, subtitled The Executive's Dropout. And there's a whole section on the 10 Thunders of Finnegan's Wake necessary for management. Mm. Now, that section was excluded from the text, which was already almost 300 pages long because it was too long. But there's sprinklings of it all through the text that was finally published. But that's what McLuhan was doing. He was telling everybody, from his students to the president of the United States, that Finnegan's Wake is a guidebook to what you're doing and what you're up against. Mm. He did that, Ben.
Well, all right, Bob, but have you ever convinced the businessmen of the truth of this?
Well, they're not concerned. It's like the beginning of Putney Swope. Did you ever see that movie, Putney Swope?
No, but I know the name very well. Funny.
Yes. Yeah, Robert Downey's father made it. Great movie, 1968 or so. And it begins with a McLuhan-like character coming into a big corporate businessman. He's helicoptered into a board meeting, and he says a couple of aphorisms, and it stuns everybody, and then they have a new vote, and it topples the present management and changes the corporate structure because of what this McLuhan-like character said. Well, what McLuhan would do is that he would not say he's quoting from Finnegan's Wake, but he was using ideas, and he'd sometimes throw in lines like Gray at Three, which is a line from Finnegan's Wake. He'd explain to teachers about children or Gray at Three. You can see his books are littered with quotes from Finnegan's Wake and are not acknowledged all the time. So he didn't always say, hold up Finnegan's Wake and say this is what it is. But he would use it in whatever context he was in to adapt it to the person, because it would distract people if he said, here's this book.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's the problem I had. I mean, I wanted to, in fact, almost say, well, I've written this. I want you to look at this. I want you to actually pay attention to this. I don't want you to get worried about what you've heard about James Joyce and did he know Virginia Woolf and all this kind of gossip, which a lot of people seem to think literature is, whereas I've always thought literature is a page you show someone that hits you in the eye. But maybe I'm perceiving literature as websites or something that hits you from a computer screen. Because people seem to have an idea of literature of rather special souls who have networks of communication with each other, and you find out about them. I mean, the number of people I've seen reading literary biographies who don't read the books written by the person they're reading about, you know, it becomes like film stars or something. You find out about people's lives, these wonderful creatures called writers, and the writing disappears. And because, I mean, some of the first writing that really affected me was pages of Blast, and I'm talking about Blast in its original typography. So I was shown photocopies from 1914 from this avant-garde publication, which is done in newspaper headlines. But what's extraordinarily exciting about it is the ambition of the short, sharp newspaper headlines. Instead of just announcing Winston Churchill has declared war, or all the banalities of the political world, which is what, or crimes, or the usual stuff that you get in newspapers, it's saying things which are directly about your life and about everything you can think of. It's about philosophy, and it's a challenge.
And that, the headline.
Yeah,
the newspaper
headline. Yeah. So when I decided to pursue literature, it was that kind of stuff that was turning me on. So, but the only realm I could find where I could explore this was, oh, I'm interested in modernist literature. You know, it was under the, do you know what I mean? It felt like literature that was turning me on.
Yeah, part of the problem was going to Cambridge and being told by the Gutenberg galaxy how to approach this thing, and you weren't getting the message.
Well, on the other hand, that's where I found out about Enemy of the Stars and Wyndham Lewis. Give them their credit. I mean, nobody else was telling me about this stuff. The TV certainly wasn't. Magazines weren't. You know, the new media weren't. And the pop music wasn't. I mean, you know, nobody in pop music was telling me about Wyndham Lewis, apart from Captain Beefheart mentioned him once and said he liked Apes of God. That was a clue. But Zappa and Beefheart were like the only people within the 60s so-called revolution in music to mention these previous artistic revolutionaries.
Let me respond, go back a bit. You were talking about,
I mean, where does Bob Dylan come from? You know, it's kind of, it's French poetry, isn't it? It's Rambo and Verlaine.
A certain phase of Dylan, yes.
Yeah.
Let me respond to some of the things you've said, because they're good points. Why do people treat writers as magical beings? Well, obviously, the printing press was the first major medium. I mean, speech is a mass medium, but the mass simultaneity, the repeat function of print allowed everybody to look at the same book. So authors became the gods of the what we call 1500 to 1900, the Gutenberg galaxy. And people think that was a special thing to be able to be an author. And it was 200, 300 years ago. You had to be a learned person or something. You had to know a lot about books. And then you got detached enough to develop your imagination and write your own book. And most people didn't have access to that. So that was a special form of new magic. And so that is so ingrained in people, in literate cultures, that that's a god. That replaced religion. That's part of the problem of the church getting weak 200 years ago, because printing press took over, and then new people could write new ways of inspiring people, which religion traditionally was supposed to do, as, besides being a moral police state. But the inspiration part was taken over by Charles Dickens and these people, or any Jonathan Swift. So there is that, and that's a precious legacy we have. And then you bring in Charlie Chaplin and silent movies, and then you bring in radio. All these new media create new celebrities that people want to be close to, and it's all looked at from the rearview mirror, old, out-of-fashion idea of creative genius. That you, if you were Charles Dickens, you had to be a genius, and you probably were for your time, but we think that that's what you still have to be. We project this idea of a creative person can make a movie or can make an album. And all the time, pop music is erasing that bias by saying, look, any jerk can become famous if he's got the payola and still make great stuff. So our idea of creativity, which was a big theme in McLuhan's work, the creative process is so misunderstood. And a lot of, like, Zapp and Beefheart come in, and Joyce, and they say, no, we're just using what you have. We can do it. You can do it. Now, you got to do some work. You might have to make a lot of enemies and piss people off, because if you get into the truth, it'll piss people off. But that whole process, the antisocial aspect of becoming creative in a literate culture, that image is confusing people. And we're always up against that. And that's why you object to the art schools. And I object to the way Cambridge, they hijack Wyndham Lewis and Finnegan's Wake, put it into the old Gutenberg galaxy, and don't tell people that this book here obsolesces my teaching, you kids. You know, Ian Patterson does not admit that, okay? And that's the president of Classroom Without Walls, which came in with television. So there's a way that Cambridge could react to that, but that was McLuhan's problem. He was coming in and saying, hey, listen, you guys aren't teaching Finnegan's Wake in a way that helps the people today or that they can inspire them. You just say it's a book. So I mean, partly, they told you about Finnegan's Wake, but like an intelligence agency, they said, well, we know about it, and here's how you look at it. And they didn't tell you how to really look at it and how to find out all these issues that you've always been puzzled about for 30 years.
Yeah, well, I'm in complete agreement with that. My project was always to have a populist form of criticism of what's around us that would be pleasure-driven and not an academic thing, passing out certificates which allow you to get a job, but be motivated by the sheer interests of whatever we're interested in and of pooling it. But I have to say that in my life I've suffered a lot of setbacks from having this point of view, and realised that a lot of people who pursued more conventional routes through institutions in the end reach a lot more non-academic people than I've ever been able to do. That in fact keeping to those principles has actually gagged me in many ways. Do you feel this in your life, or do you feel you're listened to?
No, I had a totally different life from you. Remember, I was involved with intelligence agencies, and we did influence things all the way through history, including the assassination of JFK. So we did our part, and that's a whole other story. So I didn't have the same context, and I'm listened to by a few people, but I'm not interested in being listened to. I'm in here, and I don't want to end up like Ian Sinclair, that is known for writing these novels, now has to be conflicted about how to do a new novel, and then everybody gets mad because he didn't do it anymore, and all that stuff is irrelevant. I don't want to be that kind of person. I don't think you stay alive that way. I think success, in normal terms, is not good for you. Now, most people would not agree with that, right? They want comfort. They want to slow down. I intend to live a long time. I intend to keep this revolution going. So I'm not worried in any conventional terms. You're telling me well, that what you have a big conventional ambition in there.
Well, what you say corresponds completely. I mean, forget about myself, but it corresponds completely to my dissatisfaction with conventional notions of success, because what I've discovered again and again is that is precisely what you're saying, that the success that people think is success is actually what makes people boring.
Yeah.
And being interested in why that should be. I mean, if you begin with that and try and think about it, I think you end up with a revolutionary position regarding the society we're in, because if success, which everybody seems to be pushing towards, is actually the thing that makes people boring and makes you repelled from them, what is this thing that people are chasing? It seems like we're all locked in some kind of idiotic struggle towards something which we shouldn't want to be struggling towards anyway.
That's right. I agree. And so we talked about rupture last week. You know, new art, new something ruptures people, gets them out of their habits. That's always the system. That's always what the shaman, the priest, the jerk did to people. But we got a world where we're upset constantly by the Android meme and the technological effects. So the art of upsetting people has changed. How do you wake them up? How do you do anything?
But isn't that part of the sort of dance that there's always been in bourgeois society between the bohemian and the creative and the businessman, and that they, but what they've done is that the so many techniques invented by the artistic fringe have been adopted by the straight society that the whole of straight society is shrieking with a kind of freak out mentality.
And I think that's why I would not go to an art school. I would not advocate a kid go to art school. You like to criticize the pomos of art history or art criticism. I think they're so irrelevant. They're just janitors providing services, mental services, for people who need to sit in classes. Not everybody has energy. They might get energy later, but not everybody comes into the age of 20 and has this desire to be creative. They got all kinds of neuroses and fears and natural inhibitions, and they want to get comfortable. We represent those that don't need to be comfortable all the time or don't like being comfortable. Now, I don't want to be uncomfortable. Aww. I want to be in the black Calcutta prison or something. But the thing is that there's a whole different demand. I think that the real revolution that I think I'm part of is always invisible. It's always not known. It shows up, and if it gets shown up, it's killed pretty quickly.
Aww.
You know, Duchamp said any artwork it only has a lifespan for about 30 years, and then it's the public's. And the public is just the archive. And then it's the businessmen buy it and put it up in their home. It's irrelevant. Duchamp really understood that. That's probably why he is a great artist, because he didn't get stuck being in one kind of artist. He stayed perceptive. Now, the interpretation of him has led to a lot of bad art, but I wanted to say about Finnegan's Wake, about you, about saying it's your book, you wrote it. Joseph Beuys claims to have added two chapters to Finnegan's Wake back in 1950. So he understood that it was co-created. And remember, Joyce's friend James, can't remember his last name, an Irish writer, in 1929, Joyce wanted him to take over the writing of Finnegan's Wake.
That was James Stevens, wasn't it?
Yeah, yeah. Right. And that's very interesting that he was thinking that way. That means that Finnegan's Wake was not a novel by one original genius. It was a different process. He was like running a newspaper. And he said, hey, if you understand what I'm doing, you can pick up the process. Mm. Anyways, those are passing thoughts of what you already said. I don't use any definitions of what we're doing, but I'm glad to meet people to find out what's going on in their worlds and what turns them on. I mean, do me trescu, that's a new phenomenon. I got to listen to the CD you sent me, but I got to do it. I'm looking forward to it. But that's just one phenomenon. There's many other phenomena going on. I can't categorize what I do. I'm just available for people to interact with on not in a normal manner.
Yeah, and one of the things that I find we unite on, which allows us to appreciate what each other say, is that often in discussions I get accused of moving the goalposts. And by that they mean that I apply a whole set of observations which usually belong to a different discipline or a different profession to the situation we're in now. So that, for example, a whole lot of artists have gathered together in a building, which happens to be jokingly referred to as a defrock church. In other words, it's a secularized church. And they do their performances. And I'm the one who brings up the fact that because it's a church and it's an old building designed as a church, we can't hear each other in the audience, that we can hear the guy at the front mumbling away and it echoes all around the walls. But if anybody, we're meant to have a debate, has a discussion to make, the actual architecture of the place is not designed for a democratic conversation, and therefore the people who are really enjoying themselves being in charge are actually in charge of a new religion. They can use that space in a non-religious way, because actually they're doing the obfuscation of the old religion of having one person dominating everything and the congregation unable to talk to each other. And it was considered very rude of me to point this out, and very bad, and I got into trouble because I was introducing kind of observations from architecture and history, which didn't belong. We're all about literature and music here. Don't you understand? This is lovely, you know. And I think...
I'd get the heck out of there. That's ridiculous, Ben. Yeah. I mean, these are not the people that are worth spending time. Well, you can have fun for a little while, but it's not, you're not going to focus your energies on that. Yeah.
But the way that you seem to do it is by revolving your five bodies. I mean, your website is called fivebody.com, and you have chemical, astral, TV, chip, and mystery. And it seems to me that you, when you feel bored or frustrated with the way the discussion's going, it's kind of like you twist, you know, to the other body and think, what would it look like from that perspective? So if we're talking about books, well, what would the TV people think about a book like that, or someone talking like that? And it allows you to shift out of the prison of a particular way of looking at things.
It's exactly, and I call that quadriphenia, and that's not a disease. I just recognize that we live in so many environments that I've categorized into a convenient formula or system for simple reference. But I reckon, but it means and points to how we actually live today. Yeah. We do have these four bodies. Yeah. There's no way of getting around it.
Yeah.
I mean, I hear people complaining. They go, a friend of mine went to a dinner party, and they were eating, and then there was silence, and he looked up, and he's at a dinner table, and all the four other people are on the cell phone. You're supposed to be sitting together having a meal, bourgeois meal. I mean, you got to, and this is normal. And it shocked him, and then he understood what I mean. Yeah, I when I meet and have dinner with people, I'm not just meeting with their chemical body, they got a chip body. And that's going to engage they're going to discarnate. They're going to leave the environment temporarily and go into another body, which is as important as the chemical body that's eating the meal. So, that's not, don't think rocket science to get that.
Uh-uh.
But you have to apply that to everything that's going on.
Mm. Well, what I hope to be able to do by laying out a little bit your sort of system for thinking properly about what people are doing is, I was racking my brains to think, what is it that I do that I find similar to what you do? And I wasn't quite sure what I was going to say, and that's why I wanted to do it live on the radio, because I find it interesting. One of my favourite TV people is called Jenny Gould, and she's a cookery person, and she tastes wine live on camera and then makes up, you know, does free association about what it's tasting like, and she'll come up with, you know, dust and baby's urine, or, you know, kind of the most incongruous and weird, you know, things that she says, and you can see she's improvising and it's raw. So I felt I'd do the same thing and just try and posit what it is. And I think that I have a kind of, what happens in me is a physical rebellion inside me about being oppressed by somebody's authority when they won't admit that they're a two-legged evolved ape with needs. So I think, and I find it quite emotional in me, it's like an anger or a turbulence within me that needs expression, but it can be quite easily knocked back by the kind of people who've gone through educations designed to be against these sort of comments, when they say to me, well, that's just your humanism, that's just your insistence that we are all humans and have a human nature, and don't you know that that's been superseded in the modern world by new forms of thought which say that in fact we are cybernetic or made up of silicone chips or something. And
Let me just interject. So yeah, they're saying you're focusing on your chemical body reality and you're not acknowledging the chip and TV body that's part of us. That's
yeah.
What you're saying there.
Yeah, well, it's, you see, the thing is that that's not what's going on. What's going on is a frustration that this other I mean, just as much, you know, if I'm in a seminar and somebody who calls themselves a doctor are tracing all the ills that you have down to your diet. You know, it's a current kind of extremely boring media thing that happens in this country, is that everything's diet. Everything goes down to what you eat, explains everything. And then, you know, I want to load in my social understanding of where people are, and the fact that being bored can give you ulcers.
You're just archetypalizing the chemical body, Mr. Doctor. You're forgetting about the chip body and how that affects health and TV body. Yeah. So right there, I could nail the doctor. He wouldn't believe me, but I could. You can see, because people don't want to deal with the four bodies, they're making a big deal out of the chemical body to the point that diet causes everything.
But I suppose I don't refer to the five bodies, but what I refer to is my own need for fun, I suppose, and thinking that thought is, freedom of thought is actually the best entertainment, and a kind of fury that so much knowledge is used to deny that aspect, without which, what are we all here talking to each other for anyway?
Well, Gurdjieff said that there's, you know, physical man, emotional man, and intellectual man. He thought that not everybody had a very active intellectual center. You and I have active intellectual centers, and I recognize other people don't do that. They are very good with their hands. They're physical man. You know, their physical center is dominant. So I don't think that everybody is thinking and enjoys thought like we do.
Yeah. Well, I have no problems with people who don't say that they think for a living. I usually find the few words that they say have a weight that really makes me think. I have a lot of respect for what the gruff, you know, silent types who only say a little and work with their hands, because usually what they say has a kind of weight, which is lacking in this kind of professional twittering. That's what I object to.
Yeah, now here's where you'll find, I found this four-body, five-body model is really useful. The silent type that works with the hands is not as charismatic anymore, just like the unions aren't, because people are twittering with their chip bodies and don't care about the traditional classical silent type who's very good with his hands. It's because the chemical body, and that's that world, the chemical body with the hands, that is marginalized.
Oh.
And so you're objecting to the this is part of what your sentiment for the worker and for money and labor.
Well, I mean, they need this
chemical body, and you object now to the TV body. But let me say this: when you talk about freedom of thought and that, you're always playing stuff from the TV body, radio body, your music on your show, and maybe some movies or some books. You're largely using Zappa and electronified body to throw light on the chemical body issues. And I would say, no, you got to watch the contradiction there.
Well, it's always been within the contradiction that I've had the most interesting discussions. It's not that I don't think I'm sentimental about the uneducated worker and their gruff statements. But what I do is I appreciate the stimulant effect it has on me, because in many ways, I mean, I've often, and you've talked about having a dialogue with people who are on a different planet from you in terms of their bodies or their situation. That until I can actually explain what I'm thinking on that level, it's as if I haven't really understood it yet. It's like dramatizing myself to make me explain one part of me to another part of me.
I've always said my five-body model and my explanation of Finney's Wake is really simple. I've been accused of obfuscating. I've said, no, I'm making it real simple. My stuff is ludicrously simple to what the Wake is really about. But what's funny is there's a perceptual problem. What I think is simple, these people can't even get on, you know, page one. So it's like when you show them a page of Finney's Wake, they're not even going to respond to it. So you've been real simple. You said, look at this. You can engage this. How simpler can you get? But they say, no, I'm not going to have it. I don't want that. That's something you got to know a lot to read, you know? So you do have perceptual differences here.
But where do you put music, a musical response, within your pentatonic system? I mean, does it have to be the mystery one? Because I find...
No. The music is... music is in the chemical body, the astral, and the TV and chemical, and it's probably mysterious. It's
everywhere.
Mystery landscape.
Yeah.
It's everywhere.
Because what interests me about musical intelligence is that I've always found that higher education seems to wipe out people's ability to respond to music.
That's book culture. Look at that.
Because they don't listen. But it's because they don't listen to their bodily response. But listening. I'm trying to argue against a certain compartmentalization that you've got.
Yeah,
I'm trying to get.
This is what McLuhan spelled out. The visual sense fragments you when it's extended. So it suppresses awareness of the other senses. Mm. Now, on a collective level, the reason we had that great renaissance of classical music, you know, Beethoven and all that, because in general, the society recognized they were going too, they were numbed in the eye. They exaggerate the eye input, numb to the other senses, so they had to have a huge acoustic stimulus to balance it off collectively. And that's where great music came in. Interesting. And so the industrialized music, you know, had a conductor and everybody played the same thing, reading the page. Totally different kind of music than the medieval environment. But the medieval environment required a different use of music. They had ringing bells all day. They were like numbed, overusing their ears in the medieval thing, and they didn't have any visual definition. Then the printing press brought in visual definition and suppressed the ear. Now you have the tactile electric extension. That is a no sense. It's the interplay of sense, electricity extension of tactility. So you have all the senses, a great renaissance of the 20th century of hyper use of all the senses and the media that were extended from them to balance in the to balance off the tactile void. So you can look at the ecology of the 20th century is many hyper music, hyper movies, hyper books, hyper wars, hyper street protests, hyper sports to balance off. That's all the senses, because they're in a larger extension of the tactile environment, and the tactile environment is not a sense, but this interplay of the senses. So think of that as
well, couldn't it be balancing off the fact that in terms of actual history, everything's going round and round in a circle? I mean, the hyper is balancing off the fact that you're not in control of your life. You've surrendered it to your function that, you know, when I'm stopped outside a famous delicatessen in Soho, where I take Iris, who's 4 years old, to school, by someone doing marketing research, and they do an interview with me about this famous delicatessen and why I shop there just now, and I'm saying, well, I'm not drinking at the moment, so I have some spare cash, and my indulgence is to go and buy some very expensive olives and parma ham from this shop. And then he said to me, but would I like it if there were more shops like that? And I said, well, if you're thinking of franchising it, you know, it would lose some of the interest of it for me if it became a chain store. I quite like it because it's historically specific. It's this one place, it's quite famous. There it is on Brewer Street in Soho. It's called Lena Stores. Has some history behind it. Do I think it's authentic? He asked. And I had to say to him, I don't think anything's authentic in a world where we have mass production, but it's not used properly. And he laughed, and he understood what I meant. I made a kind of anti-capitalist remark. He understood what I meant, but with a laugh, which meant, well, yes, we can say these things, but that's not really my job at the moment. Can't you understand that, you know? And
yeah,
and his kind of...
That's a chemical body concern, but this is for a digital computer
printer. Yeah, well, and his kind of irony in dealing with that seems to me characteristic of an awful lot of people involved in professional jobs. Or if you say the direct criticism of what their job entails and what it's doing and how it's basically adding up how to con people, you know, and they'll say, yeah, that's true, but I need to make a living, and therefore that's what I'm doing. So that kind of false consciousness seems to me to permeate society, and it's a fairly traditional thing within societies set up around the market. It's not really very different from the 19th century. So I think we have this huge inertia that that McLuhanism is traditionally accused of being technophile, and I can sort of see why, because in getting so excited about the fact that the people who are slow aren't catching up with all these new media, it sounds as if you're saying that that the whole thing has simply expanded and got more exciting. And I don't think this can deal with a lot of the depression and pissed offness that we've got around us in the societies we're in, you know. So it's okay for, you know, the philosophy won't be as universal as we need it to be.
That's right. No, I'm an expert on the depression and alienation people have, because when you bring in new environments, it upsets people, makes them uncomfortable. But what's interesting, it changes their sensibility. When you that person's response to you is common there, because people recognize, look, you're bringing up chemical. They don't think in these terms, but this is the way to understand what they're really, why they've changed. The new chip landscape has changed people's sensibilities, and so when you bring up the chemical body, pick chemical body issues, they know, well, Ben, that's just 1/3 of me, 1/4, that's a side issue. I've got to get a job, which means I got to live in this new chip landscape, which is a water I got to swim in, and I got to do this stupid little inventory and send it to a guy at head office who does a computer printout on it, and he thinks that's valuable, and I'm going to get paid for it, so I can then talk to you on the side again about the chemical body. That is totally understandable why that cynicism. Croker has written about the global cynicism that everybody's adopted. The average working person, they have a cynicism.
I mean, I make some other observations about that cynicism, is that the cynicism recognizes that on, it's not simply I'm a Luddite, you know, with my chemical body sort of being part of the old. It's also I'm producing the sexy anti-capitalist spirit of rebellion, which all the businesses are trying to catch hold of anyway, that I'm mentioning the anti-capitalist idea, which is kind of the irresponsible, exciting one. It's not
for
simply
the chemical body. And when you say the capitalists exploit it, why did the counterculture and the postmodernists, just the alternative culture of the 60s, made mainstream? Because those were dreams of the chemical body, and the TV body and the computer landscape came in and used them as content. And they can absorb any, quote, chemical body rebellion sentiment.
Well, I'm not simply, you're saying, I'm saying a chemical body sentiment and they can absorb it. But I'm not sure that they can absorb an active interest in what franchising does to the quality of the Parma ham. I mean,
that's what we're asking. That's the revolution. Take an active interest and confront this with the correct vocabulary that you know you're up. When you talk to that guy, you were talking to his chip body, not his chemical body. You thought he was a chemical body, said that thing. His chemical body gave you a little smirk and said, yeah, but that's not relevant. I'm a chip body here, and I need this information, sir.
But he knew when he was saying that he was denying true human communication. He knew he was postponing actually being able to be irresponsible together and say, damn all this for a bunch of rubbish, let's go and have a drink and have a real talk about things. Do you know what I mean?
He knew that, but he knew he didn't have to acknowledge it because he had the other body, which was equally powerful, that he could work in.
Yeah. But I'm not sure. You know, I'm not quite sure where I am after that conversation. Whether I'm ahead of him or behind him, or you know, where in your system you're putting me.
Well, you're ahead of him if you know that you were talking to his chip body.
But from my basic Socratic point of view, I think he understood that I was free to think everywhere I could think, whereas he, in that role, couldn't, and therefore I felt I planted a seed of disquiet in him.
No, he can talk. He can talk that way with his buddies. He'll go home today and talk to somebody in his chemical body. So I met an interesting character on the street. He brought this up. I would like to talk to him, but couldn't. But I agree. And I think that guy doesn't even understand totally. I could criticize even more.
He's friend. Probably ahead of me in anti-capitalism. Yeah, he's probably contributes to Adbusters.
Back in the 60s. But the point is, people can... That's why you have, you know, blogosphere and the chip body. You can have all people having... Like James Joyce, when I spoke to him, he was shocked at what people get away with today. But the thing is, we get away with it because the chemical body's minor and people can do porn and whatever and nobody cares, and it's on the TV landscape or chip landscape. But they all are running around now because the chip landscape evaporated their money. They don't have any jobs. See, the chemical body's got a problem right now. We're ripe for a revolution, or at least a revolution of perception of how we got to this absurd, contradictory situation.
Well, the only way we can actually keep our, what you call the chemical body, or I would call keep body and soul together, is to go and jump through hoops constructed in abstract, full of notions of what markets are and everything, and all of which doesn't work anyway. I mean, everybody does it, like, you know, everybody does the same thing. I mean, I was in Costa Coffee today, and a guy wants to borrow the Financial Times from somebody else, and so they immediately have a little kind of, are you involved in the stock markets too? Are you betting, you know, and they have a little swap of what they're doing. Of course, every time anybody with money does that to each other, they all go and do the same thing, and then if they all go and do it, then there's a terrible crisis, because they've all gone and done something, and that's, you know, what booms and slumps are about. So I had a graphic illustration of how this kind of stunted intelligence, they think they're being really clever and giving each other hot tips, but actually if that information is spread everywhere and they all do it, then a disaster will happen, you know. Just watching them do it is just grotesque, but they
remember they say businessmen, they just think in the short term. They do not look at the effects of what they're doing. They say, okay, let's pretend we got money for 3 years. It'll get canceled, but don't talk about that. I got money, I can fly around for 3 years, and then I'll be out of work. There was another point there, Dan, I lost it. You were just saying just before that, I lost it. I don't know, it'll come back.
I want to keep on with Finnegan's Wake, because I mean, it amazes me that you find actual passages which speak and express concrete observations about this and that which work, because I've always been somebody just immediately attracted to all the things it's not, and a kind of ruggedness. I mean, I think Samuel Beckett in his essay on Finnegan's Wake put it that he's talking about a sentence where it is actually the beer bottles going upside down into the crate, this feeling of a kind of something that would be perceived as violence by somebody who expects language to not be active or to not move in the way it can move. And it's like in music, the music I enjoy is that which allows the explosion to happen, that allows the music to develop from what it sounds like if you whap the drum really hard as you can, and not think that music's all about holding back and showing that you are in control. It's surrendering to the sensuality of what the thing is and allowing the pattern and your articulation to emerge from that. You then work with those effects and that extremeness. And so Finnegan's Wake attracts me before I know what it's going to say or what its conclusions are, because I trust its method, that it doesn't try and dominate the terms from the beginning from some sense of politeness or morals. It actually dares to allow the words to force up where they're going.
You specialize in your response to Finnegan's Wake. You respond to the ear and the mouth part of it. But why does he refer to all the other senses and extensions of the senses? He's doing a whole sensorium.
Absolutely, there. And I'd hope I mean, I get excited by the glimpses of. I'm just saying what sets me off on my interest in what it has to say. If you see what I mean.
Yes, and that begins it. But he's painting a movie. There's a movie going on in Finnegan's Wake. There's a TV show. There's battles. There's not just linguistic exchange or verbal interaction. That's what he's pointing to, because he's trying to make the book be as powerful as a movie screen. He's trying to pack more in than a movie screen has in it, but he has to do a lot to make it get equal to the movie screen and then go past it. And he's actually successful. He makes the most avant-garde movie. So it's not just the oral pleasure you get from it. That's just one sense.
Yeah, but it's absolutely the opposite from much science fiction and fantasy being written at the moment. It seems to me it's people imagining the Hollywood film of the book that they're writing, so that it's extremely visual in terms of using cliches. So it'll set off a world flooded in water, and you know all the films that the person is thinking of, and they trigger off these memories of the films, and the book is completely involved with a sort of with cheap triggers for well-known cliches. Now, Finnegan's Wake is the opposite of that, isn't it, in terms of being like a movie?
I mean, Finnegan's Wake is successful because it cannot be translated, and therefore it cannot be successful in conventional terms. So it follows my dictum: don't become a success. And it does that and remains, as Zappa would say, maintains its aristocratic cool and detachment from all the attempts to appropriate it. That's the marvel of the Finnegan's Wake
but, on one level. We would have no problem at all about making a film of Finnegan's Wake.
That would be easy.
I mean, because we just film ourselves and our activities, because we feel we are extensions of that attitude and that experiment and that openness to anything at all, which is also creative and trusts its working with the material and has the will to shape it towards what we feel is an emerging thing which is going to be of help to everyone.
I say that's right. We're Applied Joyce. I would say these series, this is number 28, these are the movie translation of Finnegan's Wake in action. This is a movie, because you cannot translate Finnegan's Wake into any other medium. It covers all the medium, remains supremely detached, and no any other medium can equal the Wake. And therefore, if you translate, when you do claim to translate Finnegan's Wake into another medium, you're automatically successful if you know that it's going to be incomplete and not the whole story. Oh. So this is just, for most people, an ear experience to hear our dialogues. But we're talking and tuned into the present that Joyce was. So this is a movie about Finnegan's Wake. This is a movie, a translation of Finnegan's Wake. It's incomplete, but nobody can be as complete. He made the last book, the book that remains book, regardless of all the virtual realities and matrix tools we're going into. See, that's the thing. He preserved a book.
This bottle allows us some access to a world where the role of science was to expose God's interventions in nature by seeking out the miraculous.
Who's that?
It's just a random on Esther's desk. What is it?
It's good.
It's a response to some Benjamin conference.
She's
editing, but it seems completely relevant to what we're saying, so I thought I'd read it out.
I
was having an unconscious influence on me because it was there under my eye while you were talking, so I think it was shaping what I was saying anyway.
No, that's good, but I remember what I was trying to say 5 minutes ago. In that little excerpt at the end of show 27, where you were trying to figure out what I meant by Finnegan's Wake is rock and roll in print, you said there is the conceptual levels in there. Concepts are in there, but you're interested in the massage of the oral music. And that's the point. I emphasize the concept. When you say I can figure out what a sentence is, I think I know the conceptual framework that Joyce fakes in having his chart. He fakes a chart. It even begins, the last book begins, the hand upholds the chart, the magic chart. Okay, so you got a conceptual framework there that I can tease out, but I don't diminish the importance of the perceptual music that you like to emphasize. So we actually approached it complementary ways.
But once you've been bitten by any way into it, you always find other approaches welcome. I mean, it's a model of what discussion should be, which isn't finding other people who agree with your own approach, but finding, at last, if you can find an object which is separate from yourself, but other people have places that they can go into it. We can become like weevils in a cheese and have a party in the centre of the cheese. And that's the objects that I look for. And I've only found it in Finnegan's Wake and the works of Frank Zappa, where I find that people with completely different methods from me end up dealing with the same object. And then we're able to actually not only exchange information about the object, but exchange ways of dealing with things with each other.
I love reading Finnegan's Wake criticism. It's always great to see how someone tackles the book. You know, even though I wouldn't agree with it, doesn't matter.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. One always enjoys it. Yeah.
But I think what it's important what you say to the Finnegan's Wake or the Zappa crowd is that they actually haven't expanded that, taken that opportunity. Maybe Simon and the Raton Journal, whatever it's called, they're going to try to do that. You know what I mean? Mm. Have everybody jump in.
Well, I think we've been inhibited by the same thing that's you were talking earlier, inhibits the whole of mass media, which is looking at everything through old-fashioned concepts of the creator genius and sublimity and this sort of higher level that they're meant to be on. And I find it particularly grotesque when, I mean, you get a lot of this from the Frank Zappa Family Trust, this extremely banal view of the romantic creator, when everything Frank did, as far as I can see, blows up the idea of the mysterious creator. He's everything. I mean, if you think of the plot of Joe's Garage, it's like a child's dream or something, that it's just materials stuck together, you know, in the most kind of random sort of ugly fashion, you know, that it,
and he says that,
and yeah, it's meant to be like that, because
Joe's Garage, he says, this is a dinky little high school place,
yeah, yeah,
you know,
and
I mean?
Because that's more interesting to look into than a highly finished Lord of the Rings. I mean, when Jimmy Carl Black was alive, one of the things that he and the bass player of the Muffin Men did was to watch all the Lord of the Rings films in a row one night, and Jimmy Carl Black afterwards said, I'm never going to do that again. And that for me is the epitome of a certain idea of representation and pleasure, in which it's actually the limit of the frames which is creating the prettiness and wonder, and they're absolutely iron. Nothing can break out into the outside world. It's the frame holds you in completely in order to appreciate how beautifully produced this little view is, and you're meant to find it amazing, but actually it's like being in prison.
That's right. The mothers knew that Zappa was winging it because they sued him. They said, hey guy, we were part of all this stuff, you used our stuff, remember that?
Bob, we're over time.
Well, I'm glad to end with that.
We're going to have another one next week.
Okay, thanks.
Bye, Bob.